today about the implications of a scalar dark force. And I should say from the start that this has nothing to do with Pamela or Attic or any of that. This is a different kind of dark force in the sense that it's very long range and can have lead to weak equivalence principle violations in the dark sector. So let me just start with some motivation. The weak equivalence principle is empirical in general relativity, and so we want to test it as accurately as we can. Obviously, a violation of this principle would indicate possibly new interesting physics that we have to understand. And in fact, there are very stringent limits on the weak equivalence principle on ordinary matter from laboratory tests, these so-called Etbosch experiments. Of course, these tests don't directly apply to weak equivalence principle for dark matter, because we can't quite make clumps of dark matter as test objects in the laboratory. But as we know from this famous pie chart, there's five times as much dark matter as ordinary matter. So if we're trying to test the weak equivalence principle, it's a natural thing to extend it to see to the dark sector. So we want to ask the question, does dark matter fall in the same way as ordinary matter under gravity? On the theory side, there are these so-called non-universal scalar tensor theories which do invoke this kind of a scenario. They invoke the scenario where they have a weak equivalence principle violation in the dark sector, and their motivations have to do with trying to explain the origin of dark energy or the coincidence problem, namely that the amount of dark matter and dark energy is about the same, even though they redshift so differently with the expansion of the universe. I unfortunately won't talk too much about these, but simply mention that such things do exist. On the astrophysics and cosmology side, on the observational side, I should say, that the presence of a weak equivalence principle violating force in the dark sector will have effects in astrophysics and cosmology. Everything from the evolution of density perturbations, which will have effects in the CNB, to large-scale structure formation. And even in astrophysics, there's things like cluster dynamics or galactic dynamics that people use to constrain the possibility of dark forces. And I'll talk about some of these things later on in the talk. And the main focus of this talk is that we want to make a connection between a dark force confined to the dark sector, its observations through astrophysics and cosmology, and we want to see if we can connect that with ground-based experiments like the laboratory Etbosch experiments or direct detection or even collider signals in some cases. And so we want to see if we can do that and constrain microscopic particle physics theories that might explain this dark force. Okay. So I'm actually going to start off by telling you what the conclusions are so that you have some idea of where I'm going with this, because I'll be jumping around between different things and so you'll have some coherent picture. So the first point is that if there is, and I'll refer to this as a dark force, this long-range weak equivalence principle violating force that's directly coupling to the dark sector, I'll call it a dark force from now on. So if this thing exists, it will imply a weak equivalence principle violation even for ordinary matter through quantum effects. That is, if the dark matter is not sterile, it's going to talk to ordinary matter, and so it will have impact. So the first thing is that if there's a dark force, it actually does have implications for the laboratory Etbosch experiments. So even though we can make clumps of dark matter, the quantum effects will have effects on ordinary matter. And then depending on the particular dark model that you study, you can constrain it in different ways. So for example, in singlet scalar dark matter that I'll talk about, just using the current bounds from weak equivalence principle violation and relic density considerations, you can rule out a dark force in large regions of parameter space. So you don't even need to do any more experiments. Just by looking at the relic density requirement and current bounds, you can do this. Also, a dark force can imply constraints on spin-independent dark matter direct detection cross-sections that proceed via Higgs exchange in these scalar dark matter models. And I'll talk about that a little bit.
Is that because the dark force mixes with the Higgs? Or?
Yes, it's related to all of that. That's right.
Okay.
And then also, depending on your dark matter model, you can also have this the same kind of effect of the mixing with the Higgs, etc. can also imply constraints for collider signals. And in particular, and I'll talk about a simplistic model where a simple minimal model where we have constraints for Higgs decay to photons. And the final point is that as I've been working on this project over the last few months, I realized that the region of parameter space where this happens is very restricted. And this is in addition to... So throughout this talk, I'll assume that there's a finely tuned ultralight scalar that exists, and I'm not going to try and explain its origin or anything like that, just its impacts. But in addition to that fine-tuning that we talk about in a technical sense, the tuning between a bare term and a counter-term to get rid of the sensitivity to the cutoff, in addition to that, even in the space of the renormalized finite parameters of your theory, you have to be in a special regional parameter space for this effect to be observable. And I'll talk about that more in detail towards the end of the talk. So let me just start by quickly reviewing the weak equivalence principle. There's more than one way of saying it, and essentially it's a statement that there's an equivalence between the inertial mass and the gravitational mass. The inertial mass is essentially the thing that gives resistance when you apply force to an object, and the gravitational mass is essentially the charge of an object in a gravitational field. And if, in general, if I keep the inertial mass and the gravitational mass different, then the acceleration of any given object in a gravitational field is determined by this ratio. And in general, for different objects, this ratio will be different, leading to the effect that different objects will fall at different rates under gravity. So the statement of the weak equivalence principle is that this ratio is always 1. Yep.
Sorry, for this to be the weak equivalence principle, isn't this saying that I'm only interested in objects that have an essentially negligible self-gravitational field?
Isn't yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. In other words, okay, so yeah, right. It's not the strong equivalence principle. That's right. And so a violation of the weak equivalence principle would be that these two are different, and so this ratio is different than 1. Now, another way in which the weak equivalence principle can, an apparent violation of this weak equivalence principle can show up is if there's an extra force out there. If there's another long-range force in addition to gravity, for example, an ultralight scalar, which mediates a new force in addition to gravity between two particles, and the potential of these two particles gets modified. The first piece is just the regular gravity, and then you have an extra piece coming from the exchange of this Yukawa scalar. And in general, this can give rise to weak equivalence principle violation because this parameter alpha is here depends on the charge to mass ratios. This, by the way, is the same thing as the charge over of this mass. So this depends on the charge to mass ratios of these test objects. And in general, for different objects, they can couple to this different force in a different way. And then this extra term would give rise to weak equivalence principle violation. And in fact, these kinds of effects can now be constrained through Ekbosch experiments. And these are incredibly precise experiments. And the basic idea is that you have test objects, for example, beryllium and titanium, microscopic samples of these things. And they sit on a torsion balance. And they're in the presence of some gravitational source. And if there's a new force out there, then in general, because these two are made up of different materials, they will feel a different force that produces a torque. And then they detect that torque through a system of lasers, et cetera, here. And then they do all kinds of other things. This thing actually rotates slowly once every 10 minutes or so in order to modulate the signal, et cetera, et cetera. And so they get lots of directional information about in which way these forces are happening. But at the end of the day, the parameter that they constrain is this. This is called the Ekbosch parameter eta, which is essentially the fractional difference in the relative acceleration between these two objects. And these things are incredibly precise. In fact, I was talking to some of the experimentalists, and they can detect someone walking into a room gravitationally. So here's a, sort of a summary of where we are today in terms of the... So this is over the last century. You can see that the bounds on this parameter, eta, have improved dramatically. And the current bound is... So these labels, let me explain them. So this here, E stands for Earth. So basically in this... experiment, the source mass is Earth. So they're looking at a directional acceleration towards the center of the Earth. And here the dark matter means that they're looking at it towards the galactic center. And beryllium and titanium are your two test samples, and the current bound is that it has to be less than 10 to the minus 13. So to within one part in 10 to the 13, the two objects have universal acceleration.
So why is it so different looking at the galactic center?
So here they're less sensitive, basically, because the dark... So this is the dark matter that's at the galactic center. So A, it's farther away.
Okay, so you're taking into account the distance. Right. So that's been factored out.
That's been factored out, and also the fact that there's less of it in the overall galaxy, etc. So this was to actually answer your question. So this is the statement that this is actually way more accurate than the dark matter. But in fact, there's more improvements on the way. So there's this thing called the lunar ranging experiment, which is already underway. And here they bounce laser signals between the Earth and the Moon, and they're able to detect the position of Moon to very precisely, to within millimeters. And they ask the question of whether the Earth and the Moon fall differently under the gravitational field of the Sun. And they expect to push this bound up by one order of magnitude to 10 to the minus 14. There's another experiment called Microscope, which has also been approved and is underway. And here they basically take that torsion balance apparatus and they put it into a satellite that orbits Earth. And then the idea is that if the two test objects fall differently in the gravitational field of the Earth, then they will take slightly different trajectories. And over time, the discrepancy in the trajectories keeps building up. And so they improve their sensitivity by about two orders of magnitude. And there's another experiment called MINISTEP. This has not yet been approved and is still under review. It kind of goes through its phases. And they have new it's basically the same experiment as Microscope, but they have better technology that reduces thermal noise in the system, and they're able to push it up to 10 to the minus 18. So the most optimistic scenario would be if this gets improved and then we're at 10 to the minus 18. So now let me talk about weak equivalence principle violation in the dark sector. And the simplest thing I can do is introduce an ultralight scalar phi and just couple it to dark matter, which I'll label here as chi. Okay, and for simplicity, I'm going to assume that this fermionic dark matter is in a vector-like representation so that these things are all gauge invariant. In the more general case, this coupling would come from a higher dimension operator. And so for fermionic dark matter, this G chi coupling here is dimensionless. And for scalar dark matter, this in general has dimension 1. And I point this out because the parameter that they measure through constraints in astrophysics and cosmology is this parameter beta. And it's basically the charge to mass ratio of the dark matter over its mass. So it's this coupling over the dark matter mass. And then there's this, and this is the Planck mass for normalization. There's this extra factor of C chi, which has to do with the difference between the fermionic and dark, fermionic and scalar dark matter, and has to do with the difference in the dimensionality of this thing. So for scalar dark matter, the C has a 1 over the dark matter mass, so that this whole number is still dimensionless. Okay. But this is basically the parameter that they measure, the charge to mass ratio of the dark matter under this fifth force. And there's many ways in which people test this. One is through, in astrophysics, there's the so-called tails test of satellite galaxies. And I'll talk about this a little bit in the next slide. And there's also effects in the cosmic microwave background radiation or the power spectrum. Essentially, if you have a new force in the dark sector, the density perturbations are now going to evolve differently. And so there's constraints coming from there. And then there's other astrophysical things like cluster dynamics and things of that sort. And I'll talk about some of these in the next couple of slides. So I'll talk about the tidal tails test that they use. And the basic idea is that they exploit the dynamics of tidal disruption. So essentially here, imagine that you have some primary object and there's some secondary small satellite object that's in orbit around it. Actually, can you guys see this? Probably. Or? So as this thing, there's something called the Roche limit, which basically is that as this object approaches a certain critical radius, the tidal forces that this object experiences become bigger than the self-gravitational attraction. And so as it starts to approach this critical radius, the tidal forces start dominating, and then eventually this object breaks apart. And then the idea is that the material that's closer to the primary object, it falls into a lower orbit and starts to form a leading trail of matter. And the material that's farther away from it gets kicked into a higher orbit, and it starts to form a trailing stream. And by the way, I got these pictures from Wikipedia. And basically, now if you have a dark force where this object in general will be made up of dark matter and ordinary matter, now if the dark matter is feeling a different force than the ordinary matter, then the dynamics that's going on here will get affected, and people studied this to constrain the dark force. So this was done in recent work by Kamikowski and Kesten. And so what I'm plotting here is a visual. So here's the Milky Way, and I'm sort of looking at it head-on in this two-dimensional slice. And so here's some satellite galaxy like Sagittarius or something that's orbiting the Milky Way. And as it starts to go around, and these are each snapshots every 0.3 giga years, by the way. And as this satellite galaxy starts to go around, it starts to experience the tidal destruction effects, and you start to see that it gets elongated. And the red stuff over here denotes the ordinary matter in that satellite galaxy, and the blue stuff denotes dark matter. And so by the end of this evolution, you see that essentially, in the absence of any dark force, the dark matter and the ordinary matter, they basically sit on top of each other. There's not much separation that's happening. But now that dynamics changes if I have a dark force. So what you're looking at here is a zero dark force. Then that parameter beta that I introduced earlier, here it's 0.1, here it's 0.2, and here it's 0.3. So as I increase the dark force going from here to here, I see that in this extreme picture, the leading trail is all dark matter, essentially. And there's an enhancement of stars in the trailing tail. So essentially, and these collaborations, like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and the two mass collaborations, they study the luminosity in these tidal tails, and then they're able to put a bound on the size of this beta. And so the current bound that they get is about 0.2. That is, they don't see such a big discrepancy between the two tails. Another way is the evolution of density perturbations. So basically, the idea is that you now have a new force that dark matter experiences. So the cold dark matter density perturbations are not going to evolve with this modified gravitational coupling, essentially. And so when these density perturbations, they then start to evolve differently, then even the ordinary matter density perturbations start to see different potential wells from these dark matter. And so their evolution is also affected. And so by studying these kinds of density perturbation evolutions, you can also constrain dark forces. And most recently, there was a paper out by Bean, Flanagan, Lasio, and Troden, where they looked at the effects of this on the CMB. And so you see here, this here is a blow-up of the smaller scale density perturbations, which is, and then all the different curves here corresponds to different sizes for the dark force and their corresponding range. And you can see that the lower line here is basically the regular CMB, and then as I add in a stronger dark force, I start to see a deviation from these perturbations. And so by looking at this kind of information also, you can constrain dark forces. So now I want to come to, so all of this is happening in astrophysics and cosmology, and now we want to see if there are implications for ground-based experiments. And the basic point is that a dark force implies weak equivalence principle violation even for ordinary matter, as long as the dark matter is not sterile. And it's coming basically through loop effects. So for instance, I can have this ultralight scalar couples to a virtual dark matter loop, which then talks to ordinary standard model fermions. And then I have a weak equivalence principle violating coupling between the ultralight scalar and the standard model fermions. So that's the first point. So in general, there's two ways these quantum effects can show up. So the first thing to notice is that if I have this ultralight scalar, it's a gauge singlet, the only way I can couple it to the standard model fermions is through higher dimension operators. Just gauge invariance doesn't allow me to write down any renormalizable couplings. So one way in which the ultralight scalar can couple to ordinary standard model fermions is, as I explained earlier, through higher dimension operators. In this diagram, you can think of as mixing into a higher dimension operator, which I'll write down in the next slide. And the other way in which the ultralight scalar can talk to the standard model at the renormalizable level is by mixing with the Higgs. That's the only way it can have a direct coupling to the standard model. So the ultralight scalar, which I will denote here by S before electroweak symmetry breaking, can mix with the standard model Higgs, and then that can talk with the standard model fermions. And so essentially I introduced this parameter GF that characterizes the induced coupling of this ultralight scalar to the standard model fermions. It has two types of contributions. One is coming from these types of higher dimension operators, and one is coming from this type of a mixing between the Higgs and the ultralight scalar. And even this mixing angle, as I'll talk about later, gets two types of contributions. One is coming from higher dimension operators, and one is coming from just the renormalizable coupling. And the basic idea is that if I assume that these two don't exactly cancel it with each other, then I can put bounds on each one of these, because the size of this is going to be restricted by weak equivalence principle violation. And then these types of couplings here contain information about the particle physics model, and then I'm able to put various bounds in that parameter space. Yeah?
So the Planck mass only comes in here from definition, essentially. It cancels out in the delta rel.
The Planck mass?
In P?
Oh, this is the proton mass. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's just a normalization. Yeah. Okay. So there's one thing that I'm going to sort of skip the explanation of, which is that once I have this coupling, the induced coupling, which I can compute in whatever particle physics model I'm looking at, of the ultralight scalar to the Stamol fermions, at the end I want to connect with the Etwash experiments. I want to get this Etwash parameter. And this Etwash parameter here, I can actually write this as involving the charge to mass ratios of the different test objects under this fifth force. And once you have this coupling to the standard model fermions, then you can, through tricks of effective field theory, etc., you can work out what these charge to mass ratios are going to be and estimate what the size of these Etwash parameters are going to be. So I'm going to skip the actual derivation of this. And so here, for example, is what an estimate of the Etwash parameter looks like. Typically, if I have some coupling GF, which I'll denote here by G bar, then here's my charge to mass ratio for my source object, which could be the galactic dark matter or the Earth. And then here is the difference in the charge to mass ratios between the two test objects. So Z1 and A1 and Z2 and A2 are the atomic numbers and weights of the two test objects. These X's that show up here, I'm giving you this formula here, so I'm not explaining where any of this is coming from. And these parameters, X's, involve nucleon matrix elements of the QQ bar operators. These are not perturbative, but they're known. You can extract them from pion nucleon scattering data. And similarly, now, this is an approximate expression in the sense that I've ignored effects coming from binding energy effects, the ultralight scalar can couple to the binding energy of the atom and things of that sort. But we're only going to be interested in order of magnitude estimates for this Etwash parameter. So in general, there will be binding energy effect corrections, but we will ignore them. And similarly, if I want to look at the charge to mass ratio for Earth, again, I can, for order of magnitude estimates, ignore the binding energy effects and then think of the Earth as essentially a loose ball of electrons, neutrons, and protons, and figure out what that charge to mass ratio is going to be. So once I have my induced coupling of the ultralight scalar to the Stamol fermions, I'm able to estimate the size of the Etwash parameter. And so I'll just go through a simple minimal Wimp dark matter model. So for instance, if I just take the standard model and add to it a dark matter that's in some representation of the electroweak gauge group, then I can induce a coupling of the ultralight scalar to the Stamol fermions through this diagram, for instance. And this diagram, if I think about this diagram before electroweak symmetry breaking, it's basically going to give you this dimension 5 operator, where you have your standard model Q left doublet, your singlet Q right, and there's a Higgs field. And you can do this. This graph is finite because it's basically you're mixing into a higher dimension operator. Now you can do this exact loop calculation if you like, but we just did an order of magnitude estimate. And you can do that very simply. There's sort of two loops, so you get two factors of 16 pi squareds, and there's one insertions of a Yukawa coupling, so that shows up, and when the Higgs gets a BeV, it becomes the mass of the quark. And then because it's dimension 5, you will get powers of this dark matter mass in the denominator. It's the only scale in this diagram, and so on. So basically, I get an estimate for this GF from this diagram. And there's two kinds, where these could be the hypercharged gauge bosons, or they could also be the triplet gauge bosons. And so you get these two types of contributions to GF. And of course, there's still the extra piece of the induced coupling from a phi to the fermions just coming from the mixing with the Higgs. So in addition to these diagrams, which give you these terms, there's also this term. And again, the idea is that we can put a bound on each one of these separately if they don't exactly cancel with each other. So this is what it sort of looks like. So what I can do is take my induced coupling of phi to the standard model fermions and estimate the size of eta. And if you notice, I get these factors here, which is g chi over m chi. This is essentially the parameter beta that's measured in astrophysics, the charge to mass ratio of dark matter under the fifth force. So once I know how to estimate eta from this GF, in terms of this beta, I can make a plot of eta Earth or eta dark matter as a function of this parameter beta. So if there's a dark force characterized by beta of around 0.2, then it tells, which is the current bound from cosmology and astrophysics, then it tells me that eta Earth has to be some very small number. And as you can see, at least in this minimal WIMP model, the estimate here is well below the microscope experiment, which has a sensitivity at 10 to the minus 15. However, if MINISTEP is approved, which can go up to 10 to the minus 18, then you might be able to probe this bound. Now, an interesting question happens is that if microscope does see something, then it means that this picture is changed. And so that can help us sort of figure things out. So one thing that could happen is that it could be that most of the contribution is coming from this piece over here, the sine theta piece. And I'll talk about this piece later on in the talk. And another possibility is, of course, that your dark matter model is different. You can always induce stronger coupling. So, for instance, I looked at only a minimal thing. If I add squark degrees of freedom or something like that, I can induce couplings at one loop. For example, if this dark matter is Higgsino-like, then I can have quark-squark-Higgsino interactions. And then I just induce this coupling at one loop, which gives me an enhancement of 16 pi squared over alpha. And then I'm within range of microscope. So if microscope sees something, it means that it's coming either from the sine theta or it means it's coming from a modified dark matter model. And of course, hopefully, the idea is that we will know what the dark matter model is in the near future or et cetera, and so you can get better control of all of these things. So now I'll talk about this mixing angle contribution and see what we can say about that. So I'll start off by talking about the ultralight.
Is that a Higgs
over here?
Dark matter force mixing?
You're
putting in the Higgs VEV. I see. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
I lost track.
That's right.
Exactly how that was working. Okay, so that's a direct.
That's right.
Model theory. Okay.
So, in the following, I'm going to denote by S the ultralight scalar before electroweak symmetry breaking, and after electroweak symmetry breaking, the Higgs and the ultralight scalar will mix, and that mass eigenstate is what I'll call phi. Okay. So, in general, there's some complicated potential between the Higgs and the, and I'm sort of not talking about the dark matter at the moment yet because I'm trying to focus on this mixing over here. You can always introduce these Z2 symmetries so that there's no mixing between the dark matter and the Higgs. So there's this potential between the Higgs and the S, and the quadratic terms after electroweak symmetry breaking will involve this quadratic piece in the Higgs field and a quadratic piece in the S field, and then this mixing term. And it's this mixing term then that causes this effect where the S goes into a Higgs. And then the phi is going to be the diagonalized field, which is some linear combination of this. And sine theta is going to be very, very small because of Webb tests. So essentially the phi is mostly S. And sine theta here takes on this expression, which has to be much less than 1. And then when you diagonalize the mass matrix, the value of the mass for the ultralight scalar takes on this form. And as I mentioned earlier, that we're in a very special region of parameter space, has to do with this fact, that the mass of the ultralight scalar, we want that to be less than 10 to the minus 25 eV if you wanted to propagate intergalactically and have all these effects in galactic dynamics and things of that sort. And this is an extremely small number. I came to appreciate that as I was working on this. And so the point is that, of course, the view in all of this is that all, all the parameters in the theory, all the renormalizable couplings, we assume that they're whatever values they are in nature. So they're fine-tuned, etc. We don't worry about that. But even in addition to that, these mu s, and I'll talk about this more later on, this mu s and mu hs squared, in general, they're linear combinations of some of these renormalized parameters. So even after that tuning is done, because this number is so small, there has to be some cancellation between these two guys in order for, because you want this to be big so that you have an observable dark force. There's some effect in your Etwash experiments. The mixing has to be big. But at the same time, you want to keep this light. And so even after your radiative fine-tuning is done, you're restricted in a region of parameter space where the mu s has to be restricted so that this combination satisfies this inequality. And I will comment more on this more quantitatively at the end of the talk.
So is this phi picking up significant, let's say, top loop contributions from the previous diagram that was on the coupling to fermions through Higgs Bev diagram, you know, the one I asked about?
Let's see.
Yeah, so
this
if
one?
I now, you know, take that and turn it into a loop.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, in general, there will be...
loop correction to the phi.
So,
in other words.
So when I talk about this sine theta... so in general, this sine theta, it gets contributions from various higher dimension operators. Now, those higher dimension operators could be induced by all kinds of new physics.
Right.
Okay? But what we're interested in is the contributions that are induced by dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
And all we're saying is that, you know, as long as there aren't mysterious cancellations between something induced by dark matter and something induced by a completely different sector of physics, then we can put bounds on each one of those separately.
Yeah. So what I'm asking is whether the top loop correction that you could turn this into to the phi mass is comparable or much smaller than the dark matter loop correction.
So let's see, you're...
Psi L and Psi R tops.
Okay.
And
then you want me to...
Close the loop,
right,
with another phi, and you get a correction...
to the mixing between the Higgs and the...
Yeah, to the... You get a correction to the phi mass, and maybe also to...
But those
the
are
going to
be divergent corrections, probably.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, so, I mean, but those are fine-tuned, right? So we don't care about that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, in other words...
I would take care about that.
No, what I mean is,
divergent.
let me say this. Okay, so what I'm saying is that there are these parameters, like, so for instance, delta 1 can induce, so a diagram that, like, what you're talking about will give a correction to this delta 1, which is where there's a linear term between the Higgs and the S.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But what we're saying is that this delta 1 takes on whatever value that nature gives it. Right, so we're not, so even, so in other words, there's always a tuning between the bare terms and the counter terms. You can think of it as an on-shell renormalization scheme. I always say my delta 1 has to be some fixed value. So when I add to it a divergent correction, I always put in a counter term to bring it back.
Okay, I understand, but
right,
it could be a very severe hierarchy problem.
Oh, no, I mean, this is absolutely a very...
hierarchy problem, right?
No, this is a huge hierarchy problem. Absolutely.
Right, and there's no and supersymmetry or anything like
no,
that probably yeah. wouldn't cure this hierarchy problem.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, okay.
Because
that's
the Susie breaking scale is well
yeah.
above this.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right.
So a way to think about this is that if they were to see an effect in these experiments that indicate the presence of such a scalar, then we will have to worry about, in addition to the Planck scale, the weak scale, the cosmological constant scale, we will have to worry about another hierarchy problem.
Yeah.
And if your view is that the hierarchy problem is indicative of interesting physics like supersymmetry extra dimensions, then we want to know about the existence of
yes.
such scalars.
Okay.
Okay, so I will come back to this parameter space issue later. And so now I'll take a switch to a specific model. Let's look at scalar singlet dark matter and couple it to a dark force and see as an example of how we can connect these different experiments and what we might be able to say. So here I write down the potential between the scalar dark matter, the ultralight scalar before electroweak symmetry breaking, and then the Higgs. And there's various terms. There's this usual potential, then there's a mass term for the chi, etc., etc. And the term that we're going to focus on is this one right here. This is the interaction between the dark matter and the Higgs, and its coupling is given by A2. Now, this parameter A2 determines a couple of things. One is it determines the direct detection rate of the singlet dark matter, because it proceeds with the dark matter exchanging a Higgs that couples to the nucleon, which then recoils. And this vertex appears when one of these Higgses gets a BEV, and it depends on A2. Another thing that this A2 controls is in the scalar singlet dark matter model, is the relative density. If I fix the Higgs mass and the dark matter mass, then this parameter A2 determines all these annihilation diagrams. So the basic idea in the next few slides is going to be that if I can put a bound on A2 from these weak equivalence principle tests, then it gives me bounds on direct detection and has implications for the relic density, which allows you to rule out dark forces in various spaces. Okay, so as a quick reminder once again, so here's this quadratic potential. Mu HS squared determines this mixing angle. And the size of this mixing angle is determined by Webb constraints. And we're going to see that A2, that parameter that I talked about earlier, is going to show up here, and we're going to be able to put bounds on it. So if I just look at this full potential, this mixing angle contribution, the mu HS squared, at this tree level is given by delta 1 V. It's coming basically from this. When the Higgs gets a BEV here, the mixing term is given by delta 1 V. But I can always add higher dimension operators to this potential. For example, if I add a dimension 5 operator like this, H dagger H, H dagger H S, then its Wilson coefficient C2 will also contribute to this mu HS squared. And so I get a contribution to this mixing, one from this renormalizable coupling delta 1, which is free and whatever value nature gives it. And then there's C2, which you can compute in your particle physics model. It's going to be some finite contribution that you can compute. and then basically the idea is that, again, if there's no cancellation between these two guys, then we can put bounds on each one separately. So here it is in terms of pictures. I have this mu HS squared. It gets a contribution from a higher dimension operator. And that I can induce by this diagram in this model, for instance, where I have a dark matter loop. Here is the coupling between the dark matter and the ultralight scalar that you put bounds on from astrophysics and cosmology. Here is this parameter A2 that shows up, one insertion here and one insertion here. And this finite loop induces this operator, and it gives me a contribution to this Wilson coefficient of this type. Okay? Now, to talk about your question earlier, there's also contributions like that from loops to this delta 1. Okay, so I can induce a loop like this, and that's going to induce this operator. And this graph is divergent, but you know, because this graph is divergent and we say that this is determined by whatever it is in nature, it means that there's going to be tuning between the bare term and the counter term. And so that's going to... So even though there is information here about this coupling to the dark force, we can't really say anything about it, because it's all tuned away to just fix that free parameter. Well, we can't say something about this if there's no cancellation between these two. In fact, you can play this game and include the contribution of a whole tower of higher dimension operators. Okay, there'll be, in fact, in other words, you can do the one loop effective potential where you are focusing on the term that's linear in S. This is the divergent tadpole graph. This is the divergent thing that contributes to delta 1. And both of these get renormalized away, and then you just have your tower of higher dimension operators. And so I can just sum all of this up into my effective potential and then determine my mu HS squared. And I get two pieces. There will be this contribution coming from this piece, and that's going to be divergent, and I introduce a counter term, etc., and I'm left over with some scheme-dependent quantity. And this whole thing here is what will be my renormalized value of delta 1. And then this leftover piece is going to be the sum of all of these higher dimension operators, which is finite and has been resummed. So at the end of the day, my mixing angle gets contributions from all of the higher dimension operators in this way, plus this delta 1, which is a free parameter in the theory. And again, I notice that this ratio, g chi over m chi squared, which is basically beta, shows up. And this parameter beta is what's constrained through astrophysics and cosmology. And sine theta is constrained by laboratory Edwash experiments. And then I'm left over with this A2, which I can now put a bound on, assuming that there's no cancellation between these two guys. Okay? And so now once I put a bound on A2, I can then do some interesting...
But we only have a bound on beta, so is beta completely independent?
Yeah, we only have a bound on beta. So right now the bound on beta is 0.2. So I will say, let's assume beta is 0.2.
Yeah, suppose it were 0, then you wouldn't...
Oh yeah, then you would evade the bounds. Right. So you rule out, you constrain the value of beta, basically. Mm-hmm. That's right. So this is what the... So all of this information... This thing talks to the Etwash parameter, this thing, beta, talks to cosmology, and then I get a bound on this eta. And so what I have here is a plot of A2, the bound on A2 as a function of the Etwash parameter over beta squared. And as you said, if I take beta to 0, then I start moving to the right, and I start evading all the bounds. So this line over here corresponds to the value of beta equaling to 0.2, which is the current bound, and eta earth equaling 10 to the minus 13, which is the current bound. Okay, so the singlet scalar dark matter model that I've talked about here says if I take those bounds seriously, then it has to be about less than 0.04. Now, the future experiments, like Ministep, can improve the value of this eta earth, and basically they'll push this line even further. So if I go to the future, and let's say they approve Ministep, then I can constrain the value of A2 very severely. To 0.0025. Okay?
Only if beta is 0.2.
Only beta is 0.2. Or another way of saying is that you constrain the value of beta to be less and less.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then this bottom line here is for the triplet scalar model. So everything I talked about here was for the singlet scalar. But essentially, if I assume that the chi was a SU2 left triplet, then I just get three components going in here, and it gives me a factor of 3. But the essential idea is the same, and so I can do it for SU2 left real triplet scalar dark matter as well. So now that we have bounds on A2, we can now, wherever this A2 appears in some process, we will get bounds in that process. So let's look at the relic density. So again, let's go back to the singlet scalar dark matter model. Again, as I said earlier, the parameter A2 determines the relic density of the singlet dark matter. And so I've stolen this plot from the paper by these guys. And they plot here the value of A2 as a function of the dark matter mass such that you get the right relic density. So, and then these three curves correspond to different Higgs masses. So if the Higgs mass is 120 GeV, then if the dark matter mass is 20 GeV, then A2 has to be around 0.2 or so in order to get the right relic density. Okay? So what that tells me is that I can look at this plot for the bound on A2, and I can look at this plot. And here it's telling me that A2 has to be less than some value of, say, 0.04. Then obviously all of this is ruled out, because this is telling me that A2 has to be much bigger than this value. Okay? And so I can keep playing these games, and so I have some sample points here. For 20 GeV, I have, say, A2 relic required has to be 0.15, and then the expectation for that ratio is going to be 10 to the minus 10, and that's excluded because we are now at something less than 10 to the minus 13, etc. So you can play these games, and just by looking at the relic density and the current bounds, you can start constraining the dark force in these singlet dark matter models. So you don't have to even do any more new experiments. So now we can talk about the direct detection. Again, this parameter A2, I look at this plot, and then I notice that in the singlet dark matter detection, it proceeds via this diagram, which involves this A2. So the cross-section depends on this value of A2. So now if I have a bound on A2, I also will get a bound on this direct detection cross-section. And so what I have here is, again, two plots. This is, again, a future plot if Ministep gets approved, so let's focus on this one. Again, here this corresponds to a value of beta, which is 0.2, and then the current bound of eta earth, which is 10 to the minus 13. And what I've plotted on the x-axis here is, again, the ratio of eta earth over beta squared. And on this axis, I have the direct detection cross-section, and here's basically the dark matter mass squared also. So if I say that the dark matter mass is around 100 GeV, that ratio is about 1, then I'm looking at cross-sections that are around 10 to the minus 8 picobarns in this range over here. And if I look at the current experiments, CDMS has, again, this they look at MCHI for 50 GeV, but you can do a similar thing for other masses. They expect a sensitivity around 10 to minus 7 picobarns. There's future experiments that can reach around 10 to minus 10 picobarns. So there may be experiments that can actually, that can start probing these bounds. Now, if you go to the future and look at MINISTEP, then the bound comes in at around 10 to the minus 10 or 10 to the minus 11. And now, so if any effect is, so let's say MINISTEP gets approved, and we're somewhere in these experiments, if they see an effect, then we can further reduce the value of the dark force.
So I'm trying to understand again. So coming back to beta equals zero,
yeah,
that pushes you way out to the right.
That's right.
And you're saying that the cross-section is getting bigger and bigger, direct detection cross-section is getting bigger and bigger as we go out to the right?
Oh, no. So this is the current bound. So no, yeah, that's right. I mean,
yeah,
that's right. The value of A2, as the value of A2 grows.
Well, I'm trying to do it as a function. And so A2 is, I can't remember, is it proportional to eta over beta or something like that?
Oh, no, A2 is this parameter. Oops, sorry.
Well, I'm just trying to understand why beta equals zero appears to not be allowed.
Oh, no, beta equaling zero just means that...
That is, if...
So if beta is zero...
If
so yeah, it's a bit
were finite...
So if beta is zero, then this whole thing won't even be there. So what you're looking at is this product of A2 squared and beta. And so you're saying that when beta is zero, this thing can blow up.
Yeah.
But essentially, beta is zero, there's no effect. This term's not there.
Yeah, so I'm trying to understand. So now go to your plot. I just don't understand the beta equals zero limit to your plot of the cross-section. So this seems to suggest that if beta were zero, then
Oh, no, but this is only an upper bound, right? It doesn't determine the cross-section.
Well,
in other words,
I understand, but
yeah.
I'm just saying that there are bounds.
So in other words, what it's saying is that as beta goes to zero, this is the cross-section is allowed to be infinite, which basically says that there is no bound.
Oh. Okay,
right?
I thought this was the cross-section itself.
No, it's the bound on the
cross-section.
Okay. That's right.
Got it. Okay.
That's right. Okay, so this was for singlet dark matter. Now, if I were to look at SU2 left triplet dark matter, a real triplet dark matter, then there are... So I should say that for SU2 left triplet dark matter, we still have this diagram at tree level. Now, even though it's has electrically gauged quantum numbers, there is no tree level Z exchange for the triplet model because it has hypercharge zero. Okay. And so even for the real scalar triplet dark matter model, the tree level diagram is the same. That is, there's no additional Z exchange in this model because it has hypercharge zero. So whatever bound I have on this diagram that contributes to the cross-section, I also have that bound on that contribution to the triplet dark matter model as well. So what I have here is the bound on the tree-level dark matter nucleus cross-section for the real scalar triplet dark matter model. And only at one loop, there will be gauge boson interactions that also contribute to the direct detection cross-section. Now, so similarly, what I've plotted here is, again, the bound on the dark matter nucleus cross-section coming from the tree-level Higgs exchange. Okay, so it does not include the contribution of these guys. And I'll talk about the contribution of these guys in a minute. So what, again, I have here on the x-axis is eta Earth over beta squared. And then what I have plotted here is, again, the cross-section. And again, there's a dark matter mass. And here I've normalized it to about 2 TeV. In the previous one, I had it normalized to 100 GeV. And the reason being that in these typical minimal WIMP dark matter models, the typical mass is around 2 TeV, as was shown by these guys. So we've normalized it to 2 TeV. And then you see that I get bounds that are looking at around 10 to the minus 11, very stringent bounds. And in the future experiments, you're going down to almost 10 to the minus 14. Now, What that means is that essentially you should never see any contribution, any effect from this Higgs exchange diagram for the direct detection of these dark matters. These numbers are very small. Because these one loop diagrams, they in fact, these guys showed, they come in at around 10 to the minus 9 picobars. They're much bigger than the tree level diagram. Because there's a bound on the tree level diagram from the web test. So the basic idea then is that if you measure a direct detection cross section, so the statement of this is that the measured direct detection cross section should be entirely determined by the one loop diagrams. So if you detect a number that's significantly different from 10 to the minus 9 picobarns, then it's suggesting that the tree-level diagram is, in fact, interfering with these guys significantly, and in that way you can then constrain the dark force. And now I'll talk about how this may even have an effect in colliders. So for again, this parameter A2 shows up, so wherever that shows up, we can say something. So if I look at, again, the real SU2 left triplet dark matter, then there will be one loop contributions to Higgs to gamma gamma. Basically, there's this A2 interaction between the two Higgses and the two dark matter particles. One of the Higgses gets a VeV, then I have a Higgs decaying into two photons through these two diagrams. And that then tells me that, and then the size of these diagrams are again determined by A2. And A2 has bounds coming from web tests in the presence of a dark force. So what I can do is construct this quantity, which is the standard model Higgs to gamma gamma decay rate, and then the decay rate, which also in addition includes the effects of these guys, and look at this fractional difference. And basically there will be a bound on what this fractional difference can be, because that fractional difference is going to be determined by A2. So what I've plotted here on the left is the y-axis involves this parameter, again, a fractional difference between the standard model and the new physics Higgs to gamma gamma decay rates for different values of A2 as a function of the Higgs mass. Okay, so assume that there's no web test, there's no dark force, etc., then A2 can take on different values like 0.5 or root pi order 1 values, and you see that very quickly, if I go above 200 GeV, then the shift in these rates becomes very dramatically small so that the colliders won't even be able to see it. So we have to sort of restrict to a region where this mass is less than 200 GeV, then the colliders have the ability to measure a significant shift, and then if there's a web test that tells me that I have to be below this, then I have some interesting bounds. So what we will do is assume that this m chi is smaller than 200 GeV. But in that case, I don't get the right relic density. I will have an under relic density, because you need it to be in the TeV range in order to get the full relic density. So this would then be sort of, if you're looking at multi-component dark matter models, then this might be just part of the dark matter. And in that case, you can play, you can sort of say some interesting things. So what I've plotted here on the right is the bound on this fractional difference coming from the web test because of the bound on A2. And again, I should point out that these are in percentages. And you can see that for different values of these dark matter masses, essentially no shift is allowed at all. This is, you know, the most optimistic thing, you're looking at around 0.6%. So if you do see an effect, then again, you can severely constrain the size of beta. And another interesting thing is that in these types of models where I've said that the mass has to be less than 200 GeV, you don't saturate the relic density. You make a very, very tiny fraction of the relic density. In that case, you won't see much effects in cosmology or astrophysics of this dark force because there's so little of it that's contributing, but you can still say something about it in colliders. All right. And finally, I'll just talk about this dark force parameter space with a little bit more quantitatively. So we have this issue where the ultralight scalar mass has to be less than 10 to the minus 25 EV. And it's given by a combination of these two guys, and we talked about how this mixing term gets contributions from a renormalizable coupling delta 1 and a tower of higher dimension operators. I can play the same game for this guy, mu s squared as well. It gets a contribution from some renormalizable coupling kappa 2, which is free, and then higher dimension operator. So for instance, I can produce a higher dimension operator that looks like this, that contributes to this operator, which then after electroweak symmetry breaking contributes to this mu s squared, and you can estimate D2 from this graph to be about that, where again beta is this dark force parameter. So this consideration that, again, even this mu s squared gets contributions from this kappa 2 plus higher dimension operators, it allows you to break this regional parameter space into three types. Okay, so we want to keep this less than 10 to the minus 25 EV. In the first region, I will say that I will not allow strange cancellations between any of these terms. Okay, I will be say that each one of these terms by themselves has to be less than 10 to the minus 25 EV, so that I'm not allowing for any cancellations. If I do that, then it's going to tell me that this value of D2 is going to be very constrained. And that tells me that then I get this bound on this A2, which basically tells me that for any observable dark force, A2 has to be essentially zero. And for singular dark matter, that's ruled out, because if that's zero, then you get an oversaturation of the dark matter. You don't get the right relic density. And you can do similar arguments even for other WIMP dark matter models. Essentially, you can always draw loop diagrams like this, which involve just gauge bosons and Higgses that contribute to the mass.
So why does A2 being zero lead to an overdensity?
It's because of this. Because of the dark matter annihilation. So, the dark matter annihilation goes through this parameter A2, and if A2 is zero, you don't have enough dark matter annihilation. And then you get an overdensity of that. But that was for the singular dark matter model. You can also do a similar analysis for other WIMP dark matter models. And basically, you can draw diagrams like this that contribute to the mass, which only involve gauge couplings and the parameter beta with no mention of A2. And it basically then forces beta to be zero. In other words, in this region of parameter space, if I don't allow any cancellation between these guys, I will never have an observable dark force. Okay, so that region is just not interesting. And then, the analysis in this whole paper has always assumed that we're in a region of parameter space where this value of K2 is chosen in such a way that it always maintains this condition. So we're always restricted to that slice of parameter space. And then once you do that, you still have two options. One is that in this mixing angle, there's no strange cancellations between these types of terms, and that's been the analysis of this whole paper. And if you do allow cancellation between them, then A2 can be much larger and it cancels with this. These two can both be very large and cancel exactly. And in that case, you don't get the bounds on A2, but then you're forced into that particular slice of parameter space. So either way, you're learning about the particle physics model. And so with that, I will... I should mention one more thing. That this idea of the direct dark matter detection was talked about by Bovey and Farrar. They put out a paper about a few months ago. And the idea of connecting the weak equivalence principle violation in the dark sector with bounds on the direct detection cross-section, this idea was first discussed by Bovey and Farrar. But our approach is slightly different. And what they basically did is... they did a naturalness analysis where instead of looking at these finite dimension operators, they looked at these divergent graphs, and they estimated them with a naturalness cutoff and then did an analysis that way. But we've tried to avoid doing that because the problem is that if you put in, you estimate this with a cutoff, then we know that this mu hs squared actually contributes to the ultralight scalar mass after diagonalization. Right, we know that this mu hs squared appears here. So if we use a naturalness analysis, then this mass constraint is so tight that any connection with the dark matter direct detection is not going to be relevant. It's going to be this bound that essentially will rule out a dark force. So what we've done is allowed for not used a naturalness analysis, but allowed for fine tuning of all the renormalizable parameters, and then looked in the different regions of parameter space where you can say interesting things or not. And so with that, I will conclude, and the main points, I won't go through all of these, but the main point is that even though we're talking about an incredibly feeble, weak force, weaker than gravity, that directly couples only to the dark sector, that we can, in fact, say interesting things about it from terrestrial experiments and relic density considerations. So, thank you. Yeah.
Have you tried to maybe link this scalar, this light scalar, with dark energy?
Yes. So I did get emails from the gravity people. So I mentioned this briefly in the introduction. And so people there, they looked at weak equivalence principle violation in the dark sector as a way of explaining dark energy, as the origin of dark energy. And the basic idea is that you introduce this ultralight scalar that couples to the Ricci scalar, like a normal scalar tensor theory. But then when you couple it to matter, you couple it non-minimally, so that you couple it differently to the dark sector, and then you couple it differently to the visible sector. And that essentially has the effect that this the scalar that's moving in this potential, it has attractor solutions where its final resting value depends on the relative density of ordinary matter to dark matter. And so in neighborhoods where there's lots of ordinary matter, we recover ordinary GR. In neighborhoods where there's lots of dark matter, then you get a modification of gravity, and that's most of the cosmos, but in our solar system, we will still see regular GR. And so they do that kind of stuff, and so yeah, I'm sort of talking with them, but
Will you consider a vector field instead of a scalar?
Yeah, so the thing with the vector field is that typically for web tests, they are not going to produce much of an effect because... So if I look at this diagram, if this phi, if I were to replace that with, say, some dark gauge boson, then this loop is zero. So this Fourier's theorem that tells you when you have an odd number of gauge... This is why this graph starts at two loops, because I can't do it with just one B gauge boson. But now if I have just one dark gauge boson talking, then this diagram is just zero. And so it's hard to induce these types of things. But we were talking earlier, it could be that the dark gauge boson mixes with the Z or something like that, and then you might produce some interesting effect where the Z directly couples to the to ordinary fermions, and then there may be some effect like that. But yeah, so we did initially think about trying to make this natural and all that, but we just decided to leave that to the future.
Okay, if there's no other questions, let's send some